Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
I have a gavel. My name is Adam Rogers. I'm articles editor at Wired Magazine. Tonight, Inform and me, I guess, are hosting Mary Roach, America's funniest science writer. No problem living up to that billing. No pressure, Mary. Just if they don't laugh, they're right out. So Mary's here to answer some questions about what it means to be a hungry human. So why don't we get to that? I actually want to start not talking about the book, but talking about you a little bit.
Sure.
How'd you become a science writer?
Quite randomly. I was writing for a lot of different magazines, possibly even Wired at the time, and someone from Discover magazine contacted me and said, "Do you want to write some science stories?" And I said, "Yes."
That
was it. That was what happened.
Just that easy.
I don't have a science background. So it wasn't a terribly logical thing for this person to have done, but...
Well, all right, so I have two questions about that then. Did you have an interest already? I mean, were you interested in learning science stuff?
Yeah. I mean, it hadn't occurred to me to write for... I guess the term science writing almost sort of sets it into this category that says, you must have a science degree. You can't come in here without a science degree. So it never really occurred to me that I could do such a thing, like that it was a club that I could apply to, so...
What do you think the editor at Discover saw in your writing that made that person think?
Well, I was writing a lot at the time for a magazine called In Health, which mm-hmm. then became Health, which was originally Hippocrates, which...
That is where I first read your writing, in fact.
Yeah, okay, so that's Health and Medicine, so probably had read some pieces in there. So I was in that general field of medicine and the human body, and so it made a certain amount of sense.
You were also, maybe I'm misremembering this, but you were writing sort of humor for them, too. Yes.
I did a humor column called Stitches.
That's what I remembered. I don't know if you guys get that. See, here's why that's funny, because when you laugh,
I think they got it. Yeah, Stitches, which was you try to live up to the fact, this is going to put you in Stitches.
Yeah, sure.
I did Stitches every month for a few years. And feature stories as well. So,
do you remember what kinds of things you first started messing with, or what the first subject,
the first magazine?
Yeah,
piece.
When you were doing the sort of science.
Yeah. The first. I was so excited about this. It was a feature story, and it was about the common cold. And I was going to go to the common cold unit, which is this place in the UK. It's closed now, but it was this place where people would. British people would go on their holiday, and they'd check in, and it was in a lovely part of Wiltshire, I think it was, and that you'd go and you'd check in, and you'd have the very first day, you'd lean your nose back, and you'd have a cold virus dripped up your nose, or you'd be a control. So and you had a decent chance that you wouldn't come down with a cold, but you also there was a good chance that you would come down with a cold, and your little lovely vacation at the common cold unit would be ruined. But it was just a wonderful kind of quirky, eccentric UK sort of place. You could go out for walks, but you had to keep a string 20 feet between you, so you would shout to other people because
you weren't giving
each other the cold. So right. People in the village nearby would see, oh. There's some of those buggers from the common cold unit out there with their daft people.
I suppose being Britain, there was a common cold unit and then a lords and ladies cold unit. Took a while, got it to the back, and then it came. It's gonna on radio. That is gonna play huge. It's interesting though that you remember that as being that you remember that because of course part of what you do in your books is go to the place.
It was. It kind of set me rolling, yeah, and it was the first time anybody had sent me overseas on a story. I was so excited. Plus, there was a character in there called the snot nurse, who would come in and do nasal washings, where you just kind of like drip it up your nose and then you'd into the. So it was all very very Mary Roachy. It was very. I was in heaven. It couldn't have been more fun. So that was the first feature I ever did for them, and really the first feature that I really thought, this is what I love to do.
Did you find that there was a difference in the kind of reporting or research you had to do versus what you were when you were writing Stitches or when you were doing other sorts of non-science reporting? I mean, what was the difference in science journalism?
Yeah, the difference in science journalism is, in addition to just interviewing the person who's a source for the story, I would have to sort of use them as an unpaid tutor. So people would be, and scientists are incredibly generous with their time. They're willing to sit down and explain things to someone like me who's just showing up completely ignorant in many cases. So, I mean, I've tried to do my homework as much as I can, but I don't show up with a very intelligent list of 10 questions for this person. It's more like, okay, so rhinovirus, what is?
It's open-ended.
Come on. Yeah.
One of the things that unites many of the books, even the subjects of the books, is that they all sort of deal with taboo, with subjects mm-hmm. that it would be wrong to say other people don't want to talk about because the books sell very well. So obviously
right.
people do want to talk about them, but that, right. that are a little bit off limits. Where does right. that interest come from?
I think that in a way I kind of stumbled onto it because Stiff grew out of I was writing for Salon.com and mm-hmm. it was a reported but kind of quirky regular feature. My subject area was similar to what I'd covered for In Health, so it was the human body and things like that. And there had been two or three cadaver research-related columns that got very high hit rates, and I had a conversation with an agent. He said, so, yeah, what got the highest hit rates? And I'm like, well, that one I did about crash test dummies and how you have to use cadavers to calibrate them, and the other one for Thanksgiving about the human stomach rupturing, which I came back to in Gulp. So those got high hit rates, so it seemed like that's something that people were fascinated by. And so, but as it turns out, it's a wonderful place to spend time because if other people aren't covering it, it's fresh. Like nobody had done a book about cadaver research for good reason because it seems like a really creepy and awful, weird thing to do a book on. Who would do that? So I'm like, I'll do that. I'll do that. So I'm kind of the bottom feeder of science writing. And I'm fine. I'm absolutely fine with that. The bottom feeders always have enough to eat. They always do.
That's right. It rains down from the higher tropic levels of the ocean back down to the bottom. I want to stick to that because the subject turned out to be popular. I mean, here's the
right.
thing that nominally is taboo, but of course, as
right.
you say, it got the highest hit,
right, right,
the
right.
hit number of page views on Salon. But then also, you know, you addressed those subjects, I was thinking about this in Finishing Gulp, you address them as though there's sort of the straw man of like, this is going to be really gross. But of course, you don't think it's super gross.
Right, right.
And the researchers love it. The researchers are
right.
in love, like all good researchers
right, right,
are
right.
in love with
right.
their subject. So there's, is it really still a taboo? Who is actually disgusted by this stuff?
I think that, the wonderful thing about a taboo, something that's off limits, is that everyone sort of secretly wants to see what's behind the curtain. And once you get behind the curtain, you find out it's interesting. It's not as scary as you thought. But there is this appeal, actually, with the things that people don't want to think about, they secretly do. Whether it's death or sex or feces, whatever, your taboo, whatever taboo.
Poop, you could say poop. Poop is
poop.
Cool. Yeah.
Feces, but feces is fun to say. Feces. It's like somebody telling you, you're on a diet, you can't have cheesecake, then all you really want is cheesecake. So when something's put off limits, it has an inherent appeal. And it wasn't a calculated move on my part, but I think it has. I chose to write about Stiff because I thought everything's been written about and there's nothing left. So this is, okay, all right, I'll do cadavers because that's really all that's left now. All the other books have been written. So,
that bodes ill for the rest of the writers, by whom I mean me.
Taboo. So anyway, it's a fun area to mess around in. Taboo, I find.
You structurally, the way that you set up Gulp is roughly snout to tail, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it
yeah.
sort of goes
right.
this part to the other part.
Yeah. From one mouth to the other.
Sure. Okay. See, that one threw me off my game right away. I got nothing now. But there's an internal structure to it that also where the anecdotes, the narrative stories
right.
that you want to tell also guide that. So I wonder if you can talk some about that structure. Did the stories that you found in research come first and then become part of your outline, or did you come up with the overall structure and then start slotting stuff?
No, very, very much I find the stories first. The first thing I do with any book is try to figure out where I'm going to go and what the narratives. I like to have a narrative for every chapter, whether it's a historical story or a place that I've gone and somebody that I've spent time with. So, and that's the hardest part for me is to find a good narrative, not just, oh, well, I need to impart this information about the stomach.
Right.
Like, no, I need to find a narrative, a sort of surprising place, build a narrative on which I can hang the facts and information that people will find interesting. So I spend 2 or 3 months just sending out emails and calling people and saying, you don't know me, but I'm kind of working on this book. I don't really know what it's going to be about, but it's broadly about the alimentary canal. And what are you going to be doing in the next year or so? So I do a ton of that. Because once I have those pieces, I arrange them. This one was easier because, it, as you say, snout to tail, there was a structure,
right.
a logical structure or direction.
You can sort of peristaltically make your way
yes,
to the last
yeah.
chapter.
Yes, and also I think with a taboo subject like this, you do want to start people out a little gently. You know, you don't want to dive straight into rectal alimentation.
No, you wouldn't. No, one would not. You make
yeah.
a good point. there's a lovely moment in the book where you're talking about chewing and crunching.
Yeah.
And you have sort of the world where they're studying crunch, and you
yes.
have like the world's expert.
The physics of crunch and
yeah.
crisp, yes.
And the reason I bring it up is that it's this wonderful dovetail of here's a person who is actually doing this work and clearly loves it, and you can describe where you are and what they're doing, but it also gets you right in. There's no tap dance in how to get to the science part, right? You can go right and say, like, here's what this person is studying. This is the part.
Yeah.
This is the expositional part of the chapter, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you find at the end of a project that you have a lot of people who you went and talked to and spent time with who you ended up not using?
No.
You have to scrape the notebook.
I rarely go. It's rare that because I do a certain amount of reconnaissance up front, and you know you can kind of tell when you get. Well, although I do set myself up sometimes with unrealistic expectations. Like I just have a tendency to think, oh, it's gonna be cool. It's a lab where they study chewing, or it's a lab, or the ergonomics of airplane seats. I'm going to go be a subject, and then they go and they test the ergonomics of airplane seats, and you go there. It's basically you're sitting in a chair for 7 hours, and that's all that happens. But I tend to think, oh, it's a lab and it's science. So every now and then I'll set myself up, and something will turn out to be dreadfully uninteresting, and I have to leave it out. But it's rare. It is. I'm trying to think if there was anything in Gulp that ended up on the cutting room floor. I don't think so.
You ended up talking to Inuits about eating mm-hmm. all of the parts of the whale at one point. I want you to talk a little bit about that because I want to know how you got there, because I found it shocking from the page to find, like, well, we're at the end of the earth, basically.
Yeah, that reporting I had done for a magazine feature a while back, and I had gone up to the Arctic to report on the Inuit Games, which mm-hmm. was an assignment. The Inuit Games are these sort of strange athletic competitions that could be done in a very small space, like an igloo, like things like.
We actually have that in Berkeley. It's a yurt, though. They use yurts.
They have things like the mouth pull, which is you sit next to a person and say to the other person, you reach around and you hook your finger inside the mouth and pull, and they're doing it at the same time, pulling on your mouth. And I love the last line of the description of this rule. The rules are strongest mouth wins.
Yeah. If you're Which listening is, to this on the radio, she was actually pulling on my mouth just
yeah.
now.
anyway, so Inuit Games, and then I thought while I'm up there, I wanted to report a story that had to do with Inuit food, because when I was a kid, we had an Eskimo section. Somebody procured a can of whale blubber when I was in fifth grade, and it stayed with me, and this whole business of there are no fruits and vegetables up there. They live entirely on meat. I'm like, how do they eat entirely? They live entirely on meat. How is that possible? Well, the answer is organ meats, because there's so many vitamins and minerals and things in all the nasty bits. So I reported that, wasn't able to do that much with it, and have sort of carried it around with me and wanted to play with it more.
You're doing the reporter pack rat thing. You're keeping your notes from other places and seeing stuff that you can then bring in when you have the subject, right?
Yeah.
Because you had the same thing, the balloon filled with farts.
Exactly. That was an assignment.
It's just in the book.
The Mylar fart balloon. That was a
huge band in the 80s.
That was a...
I threw her off her game on that one. That one I got.
That was an assignment. Again, a short piece. Couldn't have nearly enough fun with it. Had this stuff. I really wanted to use that. And it's just been sitting inside me and waiting, so to speak. Sitting inside me, waiting to get out, waiting to blast forth. And so it has.
And you got to not only talk about other researchers putting hands in other things inside people, but you actually got to put your parts into another part.
Ah, yes, the fistulated cow.
Yes.
And that was a... What?
Another big 80s band. So that's a pub in the north of England.
The fistulated cow.
Yep.
He's quick. The fistulated cow, I went to Davis with absolutely no idea what I was going to do with the fistulated cow, but I was on the way up to Chico to visit my stepdaughter, and I'm like, you know what, there's a fistulated cow here. Let's just go stick our arm in and see what comes of it.
Journalism,
yeah. So, and then lo and behold, there was a place to put the fistulated cow in the book, but I didn't know that. I thought the fistulated cow might go to waste, and that would have been such a tragedy. Fistulated cow is a cow with a hole in the side with a stopper that can be removed, and then you can, if you're a researcher, you can test different feed in a mesh bag. You put it in, see how much is digested, pull it back out. Or if you're a visitor, you can don the shoulder-length glove and go in and actually field, which is an amazing situation to be in, because the what's going on in there, it's fermentation. It's not like the human stomach. It's a bacterial fermentation. It's like a compost pile. It's hot. And it's packed in there, and it's moving around, and it's quite extraordinary.
And squeezing.
And at a certain point, I thought I might, my little finger might be broken. It's a very powerful contraction that's going on in this 20-gallon thing.
You should see your faces. It's fantastic.
You should have seen my face. And the cow's face, which was just like... Oh, yeah, another person wants to stick their arm in my rumen. Ho-hum.
I feel like now that we've eased them gently into this, that I want to introduce them to our special guest for the evening.
We have a special guest, and this was a surprise to me as well.
This isn't going to play well.
Don't you want to put on the gloves?
Now that you say it, I do. I was just going to hold on to the edges.
Without the glove?
Yeah, well, it's just...
Whoa. Whatever. I think the purple glove is necessary. And it's such a lovely color,
purple.
Yeah,
it's going to take about half an hour for me to get this glove on. When I agreed... when I agreed to do this, they said, also, we have this thing. And I said, I don't know. Is that really going to play? It's like, it's going to play.
It's going to play because it just is.
You want one too?
And I'm going to... I'll put it... Should we put it on the tabletop?
That's what I'm going to do.
All right.
All right. I am told that this comes from...
See if they could guess.
A person.
You know, if anybody could guess. To me, it looks like old pantyhose. Old taupe pantyhose from the 70s.
I'll try not to spill.
I'm hearing a lot of people murmuring, intestines. Bingo.
Yeah?
Yes.
I was thinking tripe alla Fiorentina, which would be the stomach lining, too. Which end? Which end is up?
This is the rectum end, but we don't have a rectum. I'm sorry to say, but this is.
And some might disagree.
This is, I've only seen this from the inside because I got a colonoscopy without sedation in order to see what it looks like in there, because I'm that dedicated to my craft. So I was not aware of the kind of the way it twists around the whatever this sort of spine. What is this thing here? I have an anthropology scarf that does that twisty thing. So it's kind of extraordinary.
It's preserved in formaldehyde and ethanol.
Yeah, it's very heavy too.
It is. But we don't have anything in it anymore, right? Like, I mean,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could. Does anybody have a pen knife?
Next.
Yeah.
Anyone?
Yeah.
I was hoping that would one of these parts be the part that got super enlarged on Elvis?
Yeah, would have been like right around here. It's the final stretch. Of the final stretch of the of the colon, it was in Elvis Presley, it was about three times the normal size. It was a megacolon. It's called a megacolon, which would be a good heavy metal band name.
There we go.
Along with Bolus.
Bolus is it's a great word.
Opening for Slayer.
There are a lot of you clearly. In the book, evince a real delight in the language of this.
Yes.
There's a lot of great words that you spent a lot of time.
Borborygmi.
Remember.
Borborygmi, intestinal rumblings.
Sure.
Singular borborygmus, I guess. Borborygmi. Yeah. Anyway, yes, you were saying. Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
Yeah. No, I mean it's full of great words that you use to great effect. I mean that's part of that's part of the joy here, right?
Is to yes.
sort of chew on the, if you will, chew on the language.
Yeah. Yeah. The language and the other thing
Come
I love
on.
Is
really.
I love in any science paper the methodology section. I go always go straight. I don't care about the conclusions. I'm all about the methodology. You know, for example, the guy who had to make the little leather restraining jacket for the mouse, and then you're thinking, okay, you made a leather whatever, and then you turn the page.
Yeah, that is just
There's a photograph, and it is. It's totally a corset with a little lace up, and you're like, and this isn't in the Journal of. Well, hoo-ha, I don't know what it was. But,
no, that was actually it. Yeah,
did the Journal of Hoo-ha. Yeah. I subscribe to the Journal of Hoo-ha.
It's actually fascinating that you say that you go straight to the methodology, because for a lot of science journalists, by which I suppose I mean me at this point, the methodology is a really tough section. It is, though, I now know from reading your book, a great place to get the narrative of how the science was done.
Yeah.
Right? It can be very hard to understand, but when you parse it, when you really go at it, that's how they did the experiment, right? That's the
right,
fun
right.
Part.
Like the guy, and it's I'll have to explain why he did this. But the guy who ate a raw shrew. Remember, this was a footnote, but he swallowed it whole. Uh-huh. Okay, he swallowed it whole because he wanted to see how much would be digested in the stomach, how much would be. Passed on through because it had to do with when you find paleontologists, whatever, they find remains and they find bones and things and they make estimates on how much was eaten. And he's saying, no. Almost everything is digested in a small animal, and so you're over, you're underestimating because you don't know. So what did he do? He took a shrew. He with a little bit of spaghetti sauce.
Yep.
And that was not in methodology. I had to email him and drag it out of him.
No, that's great reporting.
Okay.
That's what that is. That's terrific.
It's a little bit of spaghetti sauce, yeah. But right, so that's like the story. The story. How does a man come to be swallowing a raw shrew for science?
But you...
It's a sushi. It is a form of sushi, yeah. But shrushi! That's his line, yeah.
And that's the moment when it all went wrong. They'll look back on this. So this strikes me as important, though. You are spending all of this time taking a deep dive into literature in any of the fields that you're covering, and then finding the people through whom you want to tell these stories, either
right.
historical or researchers
sure,
currently
yeah.
working.
Yeah.
But then how do you make the decisions on how to calibrate the level of the science to put in the book.
Yeah, right.
One of the things that I notice is that even as much as you're taking such delight in some of the language of the field that you're covering, it's very carefully selected how complicated the words are, which terms of art you use. What's that process like?
It's pretty simple. I don't have a science background, so if I'm getting bored or if I'm losing my way, I figure the reader probably will be too. So that's a natural stopping point for me. It's easy. For example, at one point I thought, I should talk a little bit about the enteric nervous system, the brain in your gut. And I wrote to someone who's done this work, who sent me a review paper on the enteric nervous system that was 40 pages long, and not a single line of those 40 pages did I have the background to understand. So I'm like, we won't be covering the enteric nervous system in this book, it's too complicated for me without I don't even know if it was neurology or endocrinology or gastroenterology. I don't know whose job it is to study the enteric nervous system. Whose puppy is that? I don't know.
I know the feeling you're describing. Any reporter does. But I mean, my experience of that feeling is I start to panic because I go, this is the most important part of this part that I cannot make
heads or tails. Yes.
If you will.
No. There are times when I push forward and I corral somebody and make them explain it to me is usually what I do.
Yeah.
But there are other times when I just think it's too big to fit. I mean, I cover such a broad. I'm starting with the nose and the senses, and I'm covering the psychology of why of disgust. I'm covering so many things that I can't. If something's it's too swollen and big to fit easily in, it stays out. It's probably a flaw. There's probably some of those things that should be in the book, but...
There's certainly a...
But it's not fun for me.
That
it's not fun for the reader.
It's your book. There's something, I guess, very meta about the metaphor of that digestion of the material is very similar to digestion in general, right? That you have to figure out a way to metabolize these huge... boluses of information.
Right. Oh, the other problem is sometimes there's no obvious narrative setting for it. That's another problem. Like with Packing for Mars, I should have included a chapter on cosmic radiation and solar radiation, which is a serious problem if you're talking about a Mars mission. And I intended to put it in, but I couldn't. There wasn't a logical place to go and way to bring it to life, which. It would just have to be a straight fact chapter, which I don't normally do. So sometimes I come up against that if it's something that doesn't have an appealing narrative out there to present the material.
But that's dialectic, right? I mean, sometimes you have a great story,
yeah.
And you go, well, I really want to tell the story about the guy who had his house boy who had the fistula and spent all the time. You just want to tell that story because
yes,
it's so great.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And then other times you have some package of information that you know, like, well, I really got to explain how a stomach works.
Right. Right. Right.
Right. How am I going to do that?
Right. There are, if you're talking about gastric juice, you can talk about that. I have a chapter about Jonah and other creatures living inside stomachs and, you know, can anybody survive in there? So that's a fun way to talk about what is it like inside a stomach and what's it really like to be digested and that sort of thing. So and the rectum chapter, I thought, the rectum, it's a holding facility. It dries it out. It holds it. It stores it. And what would be who could I speak to? And I thought, people, inmates, take advantage of the rectum. They use the rectum for the purpose for which it evolved, which is storage. They're contraband. They are putting cell phones up there and tobacco, and it's a pocket. It's a storage facility.
Say what the slang is for doing that.
That's called hooping, as in through the hoop. It's also called keistering, and no doubt other things that somebody didn't mention.
That's right. But those are both actually. You say them as though, like, well, that was the obvious thing to go to. And they work very well in the book, but it's non-obvious. They're like, I want to talk about gastric juice. I better talk about Jonah.
Yeah.
Sure. It is a leap. I just wonder, I have this image of you sitting in your office going like, I got to do gastric juice. Geez, I don't, I mean, you did like, are you looking up at the bookshelf going like, well, oh, they got the, I mean, I could do Jonah, I guess. Like, I mean, what's the innovation process there?
Yeah. It is just about that. It's just what would be, I don't know, my brain just goes to some unusual places, maybe. But, you know, I try to avoid just a trip to a lab, and here we are with Professor Hoo-Ha,
who's editor of the journal of Hoo-Ha.
Yeah. So here I am, and he's showing me, and here we pointing out, and here's our experiment. That kind of walk and talk thing that you see sometimes on TV and is a little dull. So I try to avoid just, here's a person who studies this. I'm trying to, some of that is great, and it kind of depends on the subject material, but I want something a little surprising. Is more fun to read, I think.
But you're also shooting that through with you're doing it funny too. I mean, part of the play is that you're going to do it with humor, but it's delivered that way as well.
Well, which also plays a part in what I decide, what narrative I decide. Like, some things are just naturally, just the discomfort of sitting in a room with a convicted murderer asking him about his rectum. I mean, that, it's like, you know that material is going to be fun to write. It's going to be fun to read. It's just a natural. You can't go wrong with. And when I set this up, I contacted the California Department of Corrections, and I explained. I just said, look, I'm doing this book on the alimentary canal, and for the rectum chapter, I'd like to talk about the rectum as criminal accomplice. And I know you have some people there who are in various prisons who.
And they're like, not another one.
And he said, he wrote back, incredibly, that he wrote back at all. And he wrote back and said, yeah, I can set up an interview, actually, with somebody at Avenal. We have a big problem with cell phone smuggling at Avenal State Prison. I can set you up with an interview. Would 4 hours be enough time? Like, to talk to a stranger about his rectum. I think so.
They got nothing but time.
They got nothing
honestly.
But time.
Like, what are they?
Yeah.
But it's not, I mean, when you're doing the interview, when you're doing the research, are you writing the jokes while you're there too? Are you taking the notes? Are the interviews straight? Do you come home and go, wow, that was pretty weird. I don't.
And there, the thing is, there's not many jokes. It's really just the humor comes from the surrealness of the situation and the discomfort of the conversation. So it isn't even. I mean, I'm definitely noticing there when there's moments that will be fun, to put in the book. They're definitely, but it's not. I'm not seeing a lot of it ahead of time.
I want to stick to that because there are a couple of things. There's a lot of, again, in the delight with language. There's the name jokes. Like, you come in Gulp, especially. There's a lot of, like,
yeah,
all the names turned out to be.
This was just unique to that book. Bizarre. Yeah.
A lot of the people's names were perfectly suited to their jobs.
Yeah, it started with the saliva chapter when I contacted, because a lot of the enzymes in laundry detergent, you knew enzyme action. These are digestive enzymes because the stuff that you eat is also the stuff you drop in your lap. So it makes sense that people put these enzymes into detergent. Anyway, I needed to talk to someone about this, and I called I think it was the Soap and Detergent Association, and this guy said, yeah, well, I can put you through to Luis Spitz, and because one of the enzymes, it's amylase, which is in saliva, and what I love is just he said this with no glee, no, and then I got to Dr. Spitz, and he said, well, really, I do soap, I don't do detergent. You'll want to speak to Dr. Grime. No delight taken whatsoever, you know, and I had to compose myself to say, all right, I'll call Keith Grime, thank you. And then I called UCSF, I wanted to get a, because I'm who I am, I wanted to get my colonoscopy without drugs because I wanted to see my colon and my ileocecal valve and the inside of my appendix. I thought that would be a fun thing to do.
And not another one.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and the woman at the PR department at UCSF said, well, you know who you should have? You should probably have Dr. Turdeman do it. And he was, so I did, naturally, because I'm like holding the phone going... that sounds like a fine idea, yes. And so I show up and I explain that I want this done without the drugs. And then he said, okay, whatever. And then he said, do you have any questions before we begin the procedure? And I said, just one.
Said, before he did it, you asked him this.
Yes.
See, a lot of people would have waited.
Yeah, I should have, because it was a little uncomfortable, and I think maybe he was after me. But I said, yeah, just one question. How many times a day do people make a comment about your name? This guy was perfectly deadpan. He was hilarious, perfectly deadpan. He goes, what do you mean?
And that's how you get in the book.
Yeah, so, yeah, there were a bunch of those. There were a bunch of those names. Anyway, the names. What were?
Well, I mean, aside from the fact that they're hilarious, there's a journalistic tactic at work here. There's a move here, right? That you know, and aside from you want to make it fun to read, but
yeah,
also that helps with the complicated stuff, right? Like if you can make it funny, if you can do a footnote that has the funny move, it's sugar in the spoonful of medicine, yes?
Yeah, very much so. And I think with Stiff, it wasn't really my intent to make a difficult topic more comfortable for people, but it definitely had that effect. And I think, yeah, because it's almost like I'm taking the reader by the hand and saying, this is really weird and creepy for me, too,
right,
and we can get through this, and humor will help. So, yeah, certainly
Is it genuinely weird and creepy for you, or is that Mary the character in the book?
I would say that the plastic surgery practice lab with the 30 heads in pans similar to that, higher walls a little bit, roasting pans. Yeah, that's a very strange room to walk into.
Really, I'm not following.
Did you? Yeah, the severed head. That is the thing that in horror film. Okay, what is more horrifying than the severed? Because that's a person, their face. That's what, you know. Okay, a hand, big deal. A foot, a knee, but a head. That's really creepy.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah. But the thing is that within 10 or 15 minutes, it's the weird thing about being in those situations is that then becomes your normal, and it's like, oh, I'm sitting at a table with this doctor, and there's a severed head between us, and we're having a conversation, and that's just what we do. It's very, you get kind of up to speed more quickly than you would think. Like this intestine here. I mean, I could, you know, have a paperweight made of that and just put it on my desk, no big deal. So.
That's good to know. Do you know what you're, this is another taboo among writers, I think, but do you know what you're going to write next?
I don't. I noticed there were some fantastic suggestions out on the sheet of paper.
The white.
The sheet of paper.
More complicated scientific terminology.
Yes.
To work your way
dollop
through.
Dollop was somebody's recommendation. I like dollop. This was supposed to inspire my next book. What do we have? Dollop. And Kerplunk was a good one. Yeah.
A lot of textural
snot.
Stuff.
Snot? You saw snot?
Yeah.
I missed snot. Okay.
Well, missed.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't say... we're going to go to questions in about 5 minutes. So if you have something you might want to ask, you might want to start formulating those. I think there are going to be mics to line up at. I'll just encourage you once again, no multi-part questions, no asking for medical advice. But anyway, that's coming up.
You can ask, but I'll just make up an answer.
Sounds perfectly safe. All right. I want to do maybe one more just a quick thing from the book that just because they're fun.
Mm-hmm.
In the rectum part. Apparently,
yes.
This is what I'm obsessed with.
Yeah.
Make of that what you will. The stretchiness thing, the thing that like how big the stomach can get, how big the intestine can get. Like,
wait, we just went from rectum to stomach.
Where
are you?
You're
now?
The expert, Mary. I can't.
Okay, the stretchiness. Of
yeah, well,
all
so
of it. Yeah.
That was that's the part that I was sort of fixed on. Like, wow, these things get really big, but they're really strong. Like, what? I mean,
Yes.
I was shocked at the kind of level of strength that is manifested in these parts that you sort of we don't feel.
Yeah, and not only the level of strength, but all these protective reflexes that, like, for example, the stomach has stretch receptors that sort of monitor how much stretching is going on. If you stretch it past a certain point, a couple of things will happen. If you've got some gas in there, you'll have the transient lower esophageal sphincter relaxation, or burp. And if you continue to keep eating, and this is usually an abnormal eating situation, like bulimia. There's a protective reflex, which is regurgitation. It's like, you know what? If he keeps going, I'm going to burst. So we're going to just ditch some stuff. So regurgitation is a protective reaction to that, and that exists all along. The way there are these, if you've got a blockage in the colon and nothing's going any further, there's a foreman down there, sort of issues in order, like, stop sending more stuff. Hold on. Do not, like, the whole thing shuts down, because if it kept pushing everything down there, you could burst your large intestine, and then you're in a whole world of trouble.
You get a wafer thin moment. You got one of those.
The wafer thin mint.
Yeah,
yes.
That's right,
yeah. Exactly.
The thing that I love about that is what those receptors are, that because you mentioned early in the book too that there are taste receptors along that all the way down the system as well.
Yeah.
And they're just not connected to the part where we're tasting things, but they're sensing other
chemicals.
And thank
God for that. Because you'd be like, ah, bile, yeah. Bilirubin, So, yeah, there are taste receptors in the gut. Yeah, the gut, I mean, there's a great line, we could even close on this, which was, who said this? It might have been the crunch guy, Dr. Van Vliet. Dr. Van Vliet, I think he said, people don't realize this. People are surprised to learn there are a big tube with a little bit around it.
Well, if any of you big tubes have questions, this would be the time to express them. I think we have one there. Hi.
Anything that you'd recommend after writing this book, not eating or ingesting, or that you've given up, like Cheese Whiz or gum or pork? I don't know.
Do not swallow a partial denture, okay? Most of the time they go through without incident, but sometimes they don't. The most treacherous foods, particularly for young kids, is anything round like a grape or a sliced hot dog or a hard candy, because kids have immature swallowing coordination. Sometimes the larynx doesn't move out of the way. They inhale, it goes down, it gets stuck in the windpipe, and it's the perfect shape to completely block the windpipe. And so...
Yeah, you freaked me out as a father with that.
I remember thinking, my God, just last week I gave a little candy to a friend of mine's daughter. I was like, don't do that. So I'm careful about that now.
Have you given up any foods, or is there anything that you are now repulsed by?
No. I will always have a problem with what my husband calls okra snot, which is a gumbo and the sort of mucilaginous strand that comes from the bowl to the spoon. And I'm told that is poorly prepared gumbo that has the okra snot. But
when you put it that way, it sounds... Yeah, sure.
But other than that, I eat everything. Yeah. So.
Go that way?
Yeah.
Hi. Do you have a favorite souvenir from all these crazy places you've been?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, I've got so many. Oh, there's the vaginal weightlifting device is quite astounding.
Went right there.
One of those penile implants that it's like a Barbie leg where you bend it up and down. It's for erectile dysfunction, for when nothing else works, you can put this implant surgically in the penis. And one of the salesmen said, here, you can have one. And so, and it's up, down, you know, anywhere in between. So I've got that, which I'm quite fond of. A whole shelf in my office. It's like the Museum of Mary. but those two, I'd say those are my... Those jumped into my head.
Sure. Yes, sir.
So I'm a serious chili head, and the more hot peppers I eat, the more tolerant my mouth becomes.
Yes.
But I never develop a tolerance for what we technically call the Ring of Fire. In your...
That's not what it's technically called. I'm going to cut you off, but...
In your travels, did you discover why you never developed the tolerance at the other end?
Wow, that's the best question I've ever been asked. Because you're right. It always burns as much as it always burns. Yeah, yeah.
Freeze.
Yeah. I wish I had an answer for that.
I was wrong. That's when it went wrong. I'm going to think about that. Go ahead, please.
Which chapter did you find most interesting to research and why?
In this book, at Gulp? Which chapter is... I think that is a tough question.
It's like picking a
You know what?
Child.
The fecal transplant chapter was really, really interesting because it's a taboo thing that is, but it's one of these, you know, I was kind of drawn to it because it's very Mary Roachy, but in the end it is really inspiring. How effective this technique is, how quickly it turns around lives that are miserable, and
explain a little bit what this
is
for.
Yeah, sure.
If you're sick,
fecal transplants are used to cure chronic infection with a bacteria called C. difficile, which kills 30,000 people a year in the U.S. And it's a very simple. We're talking. You take somebody's morning toilet and you put it in a blender with some distilled water, and you take it to the hospital where there's a patient who has a bad microbiome, a bunch of bacteria in his gut that aren't working right, and you take, it's kind of like immigration. You're taking these bacteria from this land, this healthy land here, and you're putting...
Giving them a path to citizenship.
It's a path to citizenship in another land. And it's remarkable how quickly it helps, and it's cheap, you know, poop is cheap. So that was fascinating. Just looking at why it's taken so long for it to go mainstream. You know, is it the ick factor? Is it the fact that no pharmaceutical company has the money to kind of put it through, so to speak?
The best thing about that too is that nobody's really sure which bacteria are the right ones or the wrong ones. Like
it's mysterious. Nobody knows which. It's just so we're going to put the whole thing in there. We don't know who the good guys are specifically, but it works. And you don't even know. There's, like I said, how do you screen for donors? Really, anyone's will do. You know, it's like I want to. It's like the easiest way to save someone's life. Just
pretty soon they're going to be typing that stuff. You're going to have type A, type B, whatever.
Yeah,
they're going
right.
to be cross-matching it like bone marrow.
Yeah, I mean it's advancing really quickly. I mean there will soon. I mean the technique as I saw it was quite simple. It's, you know, an Oster blender. The Oster people I love. I contacted the Oster people to say, you know, did you know you're the blender of choice? And they're and I got this fabulous email back saying, "Dear Mary, after reaching out to our product development team, we have decided we don't wish to comment on this use of..." So I've been traveling around the country outing Oster as the blender of choice for fecal transplants.
It's so rare to hear an example of great publicity. That is a PR person who knew his or her job. It's like, not doing this.
Not doing this.
No. Good luck with your book.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sure you've answered lots of questions, not all of them good. So I'm curious if any have stuck with you that were especially delightfully absurd and or stupid.
That's cheating. You can't ask for other bad questions.
I need ideas.
Example of a bad question, a weird question. Yeah. When the telephone lines open up sometimes on radio shows and somebody's not screening as assiduously as they might, I get a lot of personal stories. Like, I have a mucoid plaque in my intestine and I wonder, or I'm thinking of switching medication. So that's the toughest thing because I'm not an MD and I don't know what to do with a mucoid plaque other than like mount it on the wall.
That's not the kind of plaque they're talking about. I don't think that's what they mean. Yes.
I'm pretty sure I already know the answer to this question, but does your editor ever come to you and say, "Mary, you just can't write this, like rephrase this," or?
Yes. Yes, my editor. Yes. Not as often as you would think, but there have been occasions where an entire scene was excised from...
Resected.
Resected, thank you. Resected from the book, just because I pushed it too far and don't need to tell that particular story. I can. Do we have time?
Now?
All right. This was in Bonk, which is a book about sex labs and the study of sexual physiology and people who bring human beings into a lab to study arousal and orgasm, and a little awkward. So there was a researcher in Egypt, Ahmed Shafiq, and he studies the reflexes of sexual intercourse, and he said, when you come here, I will demonstrate. I don't know what this was going to entail, but I showed up, and there was whoever he'd recruited had left town. So he said, I'm really sorry, I can't show you that, but I've got a man here, and he's agreed to let me demonstrate another reflex for you, and it was the anal wink reflex, which is very cute. It's like a... and for our radio listeners, you probably don't need an explanation, but it winks.
You're in now.
So I left that scene in, and then I went to... I just took it a little too far in that, because I'm... All right, Dr. Shafiq has one of those pointers, so he's pointing with the pointer, and he does a little scratch, which makes it wink, and I'm, and we're both about 6 inches from this man's winking or orifice, and I flashed on something from when I was a kid. There were these sugar Easter eggs with a little opening that you would look through and see the bunnies inside and everything. And I kind of flashed on that memory from childhood, and my editor's just like, no. Whole thing gone. Yeah.
And that's how Mary killed Easter. Do we have more?
So, yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
So I have, it's against the rules, but a two-part question. What is the...
you didn't work here.
So what is your grossest moment in having experimented and, researched these books? And what is the moment that you felt would be the grossest but was surprisingly normal?
Oh, okay. I have to say the grossest... I think it's the same. The answer is the same because I think it was the trip to the Body Farm in Stiff. The Body Farm is a forensics facility where they study decomposition and the timeline of decomposition, which enables you to pinpoint the time of death. So depending on the weather, is the body buried in sand or mud? Is it in the backseat of the car or the trunk of the car? All these different variables influence how the body decomposes. So I went to the Body Farm, and it is indeed, it's overwhelming because it's not just visual, it's olfactory, and even you could hear the maggots. If you put your head, of course the researcher's like, put your ear right down here, you can hear the maggots. And like an idiot, I'm like, okay. just the sensory onslaught of that was overwhelming and objectively quite upsetting and disgusting. But what usually happens with me is my curiosity and my interest in what's being explained to me and what I'm seeing trumps the revulsion. So it becomes a really interesting and incredible afternoon, even though, yeah, gross. So I guess it's that would be the grossest and also not as upsetting as you would think.
Can I ask? I'll come back in a second, but moderator's privilege. Sorry. Who do you read? Who are the writers who you want to write like, or either working now or back?
I think the writer that comes to mind that really inspired me early on in my career is Bill Bryson, for his ability to explain and introduce facts and have a narrative and be funny and seamlessly do that, and also never put out a sentence that is stale or flat. There's always a word choice or a way it's turned. It's always perfect.
Yeah. So Jerk.
Yeah. Susan Orlean, also feel the same way about Susan Orlean's writing. Just always fresh, and her relationship with the people that she's with. I always look forward to those two.
These are people with both great kind of the macro level of subject choice and ability to explain stuff, but also on a word by word, sentence by sentence scale. They're just a delight to read.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Go ahead. Yeah, please.
When you're in the process of writing your book, do you ever flash on a specific film, a scientific film like Alien or Contagion or anything like that?
Yeah. Alien, of course. Alien came up a lot. There's a chapter in Gulp that had to do with whether it's a section that has to do with whether mealworms can in fact eat their way out of lizard stomach, which is this internet myth, and people in the herpetofauna community are like, you got to kill the meal, you got to cut it, get its head off first because it'll eat its way out. It's like, no, it won't. It won't. Anyway, but we were talking
come
about
on, that, people.
talking about how the part of where that might have started, and the researcher who did the experiment to debunk this said he thought it tied into the scene in Alien, that kind of lodged in people's subconscious and this sense that this the horror of something eating its way through the body and,
I mean,
and
reason
escaping.
The reason it's called visceral, right? I mean, that's the like the feeling of like something inside you that you can't control because there's already. I mean, that's part of there is that sense in Gulp that there's this stuff going on inside you that you just are not controlling it and it's doing things.
It's doing its thing. And there's that wonderful in the 1700s, 1800s, this not an epidemic, but a lot of case reports of stomach snakes, stomach frogs, people feeling things going on in their stomach and their intestines. Not knowing what it was and thinking, whoa, I drank from a pond a while back. I must have had some eggs and they've hatched inside me. And you know, there's case report after case report, slugs, frogs, snakes, people believing, and doctors in some cases also believing that was the case. Yeah.
So that's terrible.
So anyway,
next question.
Sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm wondering what your thoughts are on probiotics and whether they really work and if you learned anything cool or interesting about probiotics.
Sure. Well, a fecal transplant is like the ultimate.
Talk about a probiotic. That's the pro level.
But the thing with a fecal transplant is we're talking about a cup or more of material. I mean, you need, can I say a shitload? I probably can't.
You cannot.
Cannot. Oh, well. And I had a conversation with both the doctor who does the fecal transplants and also the Center for Research and Development in Probiotics in Canada. And he said, you know, the idea is sound, but 95% of these products that are being marketed now have not been tested on humans and shouldn't be called probiotics. It's tough to make some, because a lot of the gut bacteria are anaerobic. They survive in a very specific environment that you can't, in a lab, it's expensive and complicated to kind of make the stuff. And in a small capsule, you know, would there be enough? Would it survive? And is there enough of it? It's tough. It's kind of tough to... there are examples. Lactobacillus works well for treating yeast infections, I'm told. I mean, so there are some examples of it, but the bottom line is I asked Alexander Korutz, who was the fecal transplanter, I said, so those capsules, those probiotic capsules, what is in them? He said, marketing. So, there's the intent is good, and I think we're heading towards a lot more use of bacterial. I mean, earwax, you can do a transplant of earwax. I don't know if it's bacteria. What's in it? Mouth. Yeah, and there's all kinds of sort of like take this and shove it in there and see if it works. So it's really in the infancy now. But there's just, as always, when there's something exciting and new, there are people rushing to profit on it. And right now, there's not much regulation of those things.
It's so tough, too, because the connection between your kind of state of mind and what your gut is doing is so intense as well that if you're taking something that has a placebo effect, there would be a reason that you would not have as much.
Right, and if there is a placebo effect and you feel better, then why the hell not? Whatever. So it's tough, kind of a tough, it's an interesting topic. Yeah.
Yes.
I was curious about vomiting.
Who isn't?
Because if, like when you were talking about the cadavers and the olfactory, the first thing I thought of is I would vomit just from the smell. Or if you hear somebody else vomit, then I vomit. Like what's going on there? Like Could you explain?
Nausea. There's a contagiousness with nausea, and I don't know what the mechanism is to it, but it's definitely because when I was on the vomit comet for packing for Mars, when somebody starts to lose it, they like float that guy to the back fast because everybody's going to start throwing up. The smell and the sound.
Yeah. I did that, and I did that.
What?
I did that, and I did
And you did?
That.
Yes. You were one of the guys?
I was a kill, yes.
Oh, you were a kill. Oh, no, because you did somersaults, didn't you?
I wish I could say it was something that cool. It was I got really sick. Yeah.
Did you take drugs first?
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is, you know what this thing is. This is the plane that NASA uses that does these parabolic arcs, and at the top, the equivalent of zero gravity of
right.
weightlessness, because you're coming over and the plane's flying over, and depending on what your crowd is, either nobody will get sick or kind of everybody will get sick. And actually, mine was one of the
so everybody got
almost everybody. Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. Wow.
Which I was not first. It wasn't my fault. You can't.
We just had one guy, his name was Pat, and he was sick before they started doing the parabolas. It was this calm flight we went over to the Gulf of Mexico or wherever we were. It was,
yeah.
And that poor guy, he was, and it's not, the thing, when you're in that situation and somebody floating above you is getting sick, when you go up, it's going to be double gravity. That's just going to be splatting at twice the weight. So you got to get out of the way. You're like this.
Scrambling, floating.
It's hard to get traction.
It's like Tom and Jerry in the air. They give you a flight suit. You know, cool. You feel like Chuck Yeager. You get a flight suit, and they give you
with your name on it.
With your name, and they give you in the pocket. They give you a barf bag that you keep in the pocket, and they tell you to blouse it out of the pocket so that you can get to it, you know, because you got to cover it. And it looks like nothing so much as a carnation on a lapel. But you're like, I'm going to throw up in that in a few minutes.
Oh.
Yeah, but it is. But that contagious. And there's like, that's an evolutionary biology thing, right? Like if you're sitting around the campfire, if one of you has just eaten something.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's like the Just So story about that. I don't know if that's.
Sure, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, you like get it out of you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are we going over here now?
Yeah. We'll trade off. I think it's the side's turn.
You did you had a colonoscopy done without drugs. Would you do it again? And why? Why do you think that so many people don't do a painless procedure without drugs?
It's not painless.
It was painless for me. It was fascinating.
Depends on a number of things, but that's great that it was painless. I will say that in Europe, it's done sedation on demand, which is it's set up. The drugs are set up and ready to go if you need them. And 80% of people do not bother with the drugs. So it's certainly something that's bearable. And I don't. And that's a good question. I think there's no need to get them up front. I think a lot of people like the drugs is the answer. But mine was uncomfortable but bearable. Yeah. And you're small around. It's usually like the smaller you are around, the more painful it is.
The nurse will push down to offset the pressure of the instrument going up.
You got one of those good health plans.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Obamacare at work gets you the right.
Drugs, we over-drug in this country, I think, for procedures.
It's fascinating.
We're
all I can say.
This will be the last one here.
I'm just wondering, I take my dog to the dog park, and some of the puppies eat the feces of the other animals.
Yes.
Is there something in it for them? And secondly, would there be something in it for me?
I think you should take those in the reverse order, because...
I actually cover this in the book. For some animals, eating your own is like it's like a vitamin supplement. With dogs, and I was at the pet food company, and I was saying, because when things have decomposed and broken down, I was saying, well, there's no nutrition in it. And the guy was like, no, there is. There is nutrition. There is still stuff in there that's nutritious. And also, it's been broken down, so now some of the vitamins are available that weren't available before. So you run it through again. And rodents and rabbits do this. They eat it coming out of their own butt. I mean, it's called a secretrophe, so that it sounds better.
That's a whale, secretrophe. You can't...
Secretrophe.
Cetaceans. Nobody, nothing? Nobody, really? Sorry, secretrophe.
Secretrophe, not cetotroph.
Right.
Secretrophe. So... Anyway, the one of the theories on dogs is that they may be lacking in some nutrient, and it's been broken down, and now it's available there and it smells so good.
And with the bunny rabbits, they're getting at some of the cellulose too. They're doing that. They're doing a thing that, that like ruminants will do in the multiple stomachs.
Yeah, it's similar to rumination. Yeah, they're getting, but there's vitamin B and K, and there's a number of things and that they can't otherwise get. And if you prevent them with that lovely leather restraining outfit that was mentioned earlier, if you prevent them from eating it, they become malnourished and they lose weight. And so it's a regular part of dinner.
Again, though, Mary's not a doctor, so don't, you know, this, you shouldn't take this as a recommendation. Let's do the last question. This is an informed tradition, is to ask your 60 second, right, ideas that would change the world.
Fart merrily and with gusto.
Please thank you. Thank Mary Roach for this. That's right. And this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club, we are adjourned.